Yes, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Zoom session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 16th, 2024. We have three cases on our oral calendar this morning, two non-orals. The first case before us is A23-1453, A23-1820, Todd C. Dooley et al. Versus Jason R. Ross et al. Counsel, as you undoubtedly know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. We are recording this Zoom session, and no other recordings are permitted. The audio version only will be posted on our website later. When each of you begins your argument, if you could please state your name and the parties you represent for the record. And I believe with that, we are ready for counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. It's nice to see everyone this morning. To start out my argument today, I think, I filed a pretty long brief and a pretty extensive reply. So I think to start out, I wanted to bring the court's attention to something that I think is perhaps something that may be missed by the briefs, but is covered by the appendix and by the record. And if you go to the addendum, which I filed in this case, I filed a number of things, and one of them was I filed the notice of filing certification of records from the Minnesota Department of Corrections. It's an AA15 to AA20. And in this case, what caused really all of this controversy is the fact that I use Rule 45 to subpoena to obtain documents that I learned about in the last 30 days leading up to a trial, because a friend came to my client, told him that he had been talking to this gentleman in prison. And I got 803 calls from the Minnesota Department of Corrections between Mr. Ross and this gentleman, Mr. I can't even pronounce his name, I don't believe, Seth DiLorenzo.
Mr. Dahl, could I interrupt you a moment? You say that caused it, but wasn't the motion to compel nearly a year earlier, which led to the ultimate sanction, which is what's before our court now, not directly, as I understand it, maybe indirectly, that subpoena you're referring to?
The judge hadn't dismissed the case up to this point. He had denied the motion for summary judgment. And what happened was this precipitated it, because at this point, I got records now proving absolutely from the Department of Corrections that are certified that prove that Mr. Ross is a liar. And frankly, if he went ahead and testified at this trial, he would have been subject to prosecution for perjury.
But
So,
Mr. Dahl,
Mr. Tuck.
what I was getting at is that you use the phrase that that's what caused this. I assume by this you're referring to the original motion to compel, which led to ultimately the dismissal. And my understanding from the district court's order, it was not related to those 800 messages you're now referring to. So I'm not sure I understand what you mean this caused it. I don't see anything in the record to say it caused the sanction. The sanction, as I understand it, was the failure to comply with the discovery order that was from nearly the year or the summer earlier, July of the previous year.
Well, I'm going to get into that. I just want to explain to the court what happened was I filed an exhibit list in May, and he was upset that I filed exhibit list the night before, and I added exhibits 50 to 56 to the exhibits, because there were like 100 and I don't know, it was 100 maybe up to 110 exhibits from the depositions. So I added basically six or seven exhibits that were from this thing, and this that kind of precipitated him going into this, that whatever he went into there. And I'll go back into arguing that other issue, But I want to go into this first because it needs to be highlighted. Because the reason the judge and the reason Mr. Clutcher went ballistic is because if you go to the documents that I filed, let's go say you go to Exhibit 50, and then you go look at specifically at page look at the pages, and there are 803 calls. I put in the record in these exhibits that the man that he was calling in prison was convicted of rape twice. Mr. Ross was receiving legal advice from a man that was a rapist that had been convicted twice in prison. There was evidence in the case from Wyatt Dooley that Mr. Ross had been taking pictures of the daughter of one of his girlfriends.
Mr. Dahl, may I pause for, I appreciate that you want to discuss those calls, but I am looking at the district court's order and the procedural history updated this time. And as I understand it, there was, you know, a motion to compel in the spring of 92, I guess, is that when it was? Wait, when was the first order, the July order? And I'm getting my years confused. An order to compel was in July. Then in the fall, I believe there was a second motion to compel around September, perhaps. That was postponed then till later due to an extension by the court. There was a motion for sanctions. And all of that, I believe, occurred, those motions, by April of the following year. And I think the disclosure that you're talking about for the calls is all after that, right? So the district court had pending before it motions to compel following its order compelling discovery and a motion for sanctions.
The district court's order on the motion to compel was frivolous. And I'm going to go into this later on as I did this. I'm going to read this because I want this in the record. This is what Mr. Ross said on page AA37 of the addendum. So I told him we'll split it 50-50. How does that sound? And you supply the loader. Well, then the effing day he's like, oh, I didn't like how you tried to whatever. It's pretty ugly what he said. And then I want you to know on page AA39, he says maybe he'll have a heart attack talking about Mr. Dooley and he can steal my client's land.
But so Mr. Dahl,
go ahead.
I think the point of the question and the question I have is that it doesn't appear to me that the dismissal of this action with prejudice turned on the merits of the competing claims between the parties at all, but rather on your client's failure to comply with the motion, with the orders to compel. Can you point me to anything in the dismissal order from July 2023 that suggests otherwise, that suggests that the dismissal turned on the merits of the claims in any regard?
Because I believe the judge was protecting Mr. Clutcher, who's a personal friend of his. And my point of view
again, counsel, is there, can you point me, Mr. Dahl, to something in the court's order that suggests the decision is based on the merits of the claims?
It would be in the transcript. The transcript of the argument that day. No, I don't have anything here, but it's in the record. There was a transcript. I paid for the transcript. It's cited in the record, and I've cited to it somewhere in my brief. Can I go back to my argument?
Go ahead.
In this case, Mr. Ross lost the MSJ. The judge still hadn't ruled on that. If you go back to the motion to compel, which is what he's attacking me on, what happened was I sent the objections and I sent answers out, but my client didn't sign the verification because he had not had the opportunity to review it. So he could never verify that. And Mr. Clutcher filed a motion to compel before he even called me to confer on this. There was no good faith. Mr. Clutcher never certified it. The district court treated Mr. Clutcher different than he treated me. I was in this situation. At the time that Mr. Clutcher had the motion heard, the motion was heard on my first set of answers to interrogatories. I amended those answers to interrogatories. That made the first set of answers moot. He ordered me to order my client to sign documents. My client told me he could not verify that they were true.
Can I ask, Mr. Dahl, first of all, by the time that, just to make sure I understand, by the time that the motion was decided, and maybe even heard, but definitely decided in July of 2022, the district court had before it the amended answers as well, correct?
The judge didn't even consider the amended answers.
Well, it had, they had already been served.
They correct? Were served a couple weeks after the originals were served.
Okay, because then, and I think that the order specifically says that the originals had to be signed, executed by your, or verified by your client. When there were some verifications, I think that were filed in July of 2023, right? What did your client verify? It looked like, I'm not sure what those verifications go to in July of 2023, the year after the order.
They just go to the amended verification, the amended answers. Yeah.
Okay. And did you ever say, is it in the record? Because I was comparing the answers and trying to see how they differed. What did, was it ever in the record? What it was that was untrue in the first ones that could not be certified?
Did no, you ever it wasn't in the record because that was confidential conference between client, attorney-client privilege stuff that my client discussed with me that he could not say that the, what I said there was true, that I misunderstood what he said. And,
okay, but he could sign and certify as true that which was in the amended responses.
Yes,
okay.
That's true.
But yeah. You didn't point out ever at any time to the district court why, what couldn't be true because you consider that privileged. Is that right?
That's well, we never discussed it directly. If you're asking me if we discussed, I can't represent that we talked about that directly, but I didn't talk about it because it was attorney-client privilege as far as I was concerned. Is that answer your question?
Mr. Dahl,
sure,
I presume that there's no dispute that an unsigned answer to interrogatory does not satisfy the rules. So my question, first off, that would be an appropriate order to do. Was the court aware specifically, even if not detail, prior to its ruling that the language in there was based on your misunderstanding and therefore it was untrue?
Well, here's what happened. What happened was that my client, as far as he was concerned, the agreement was with three people. It was with Jason Ross. It was with the Great Lakes company he worked for and the new company he created. Because as far as he was concerned, he had dealt with all three. The offer that Mr. Ross sent was an email from Great Lakes Lumber attaching an agreement between Ross and Dooley and the other thing. The other thing is there was originally verification sent in May of 2022. But the reason that the court had a problem with him was because he verified the answer to interrogatories as to, it was an answer that was to all, relating to all three companies. And so one of the things the judge asked us to do, which I did not understand, and later I understood it after Mr. Kletcher filed some additional stuff, he wanted us to do a six different answers to each. Basically, I had to do six because there was Mr. Dooley, and then there was Wyatt Excavating, his company. So I had to answer Mr. Dooley's interrogatories three times because there were three parties. And then Mr. Had to answer the other ones three times and give a verification. I'd already given a verification in May of 2022. So the one that happened in July was, it was, I just divided them up, but the answers didn't change anyway. There were no new revelations. Mr. Kletcher couldn't point to any new revelations. All that happened was there was a verification back then in May. Now I did six verifications. So we're verifying as all of them. So I wanted Mr. Kletcher to be able to cross my client regarding any one of the six different entities. So he could say, well, you verified this as to this, this, and this. And I didn't see any problem with doing that. And that's what Mr. Kletcher had said in, I think he filed four or five different pleadings on the motion to compel, which again, I objected to because the motion deadline for discovery was over in March of 2023.
Mr. Dahl,
Yeah.
and you're what I see in the briefing and in the arguments below is a lot of times disagreeing, and you're kind of doing that again today with the court's order. But the question is really, for sanction purposes, is why you did not comply with the order in a timely manner. So even some of these examples you're giving today, could not your client have submitted an affidavit within 7 days, along with an amended answer? The affidavit would explain why the first one's not signed, and then have an amended answer within the 7 days, and that would have resolved the issue. And
because I didn't understand what the judge wanted, I didn't understand what he wanted.
Let me let you mean you didn't understand the July 2022 order?
I didn't understand that he wanted me to answer it six times. That's the point I'm making, Your Honor.
Did you ask the court to explain then? And the memorandum seems to go in quite detail the things your client needed to do to comply. Did you notify the court of a particular one of those, such as the six times you're referring to get clarification?
I just didn't. I at the time he didn't. He we didn't clarify it. I don't know why. We discussed this at the motion for summary judgment hearing. He didn't ask me at that time or discuss with me. Say,
what I'm getting at is you said you didn't understand the court's order or directive, but when I look at the memorandum, and it seems to be fairly clear, at least to me, the main point on the number of parties is you got multiple parties, and that just needed to answer the interrogatories for each one of the parties. Isn't that correct?
Yes, and I thought the judge understood that I was treating them as one because I had alleged that we were piercing the corporate veil. And as far as we were concerned, they'd been treated as one. So,
and counsel, we're at the end of your time, but let me, and you will have time for rebuttal. Let me ask one question then. Apart from the verifications, did you serve separate responses for each plaintiff as to each defendant?
Yes.
Okay, and when did you do that?
In July of 2023, but they were the same exact responses.
Thank you. And counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. And if you will mute while we turn to counsel for respondent. Mr. Dahl, could you hit mute on your computer there? Great. And we will do the same. Thank you, Mr. Clutcher. We're ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Bradley Clutcher of Barna, Guzzi, and Stefan on behalf of the respondents in this matter. The district court did not abuse its discretion in it dismissing the First Amended complaint of the appellants in this matter for failure to comply with the court's discovery orders. In examining whether a dismissal is appropriate in an abuse of discretion, the court looks at five factors as set out in the Frontier case. I want to address each of those five factors here before the court and explain what transpired with the court below. The first factor is the setting of a date certain for compliance. In this particular matter, the court issued an order on July 20th of 2022, specifically outlining in a very detailed memorandum of law and court order that compliance that was required. And the order specifically required the production of documents within 7 days. Discovery at that point in time was already expired, and the court moved out the discovery deadline to December 9th of 2022. During that period of time, no supplementation at all, zero supplementation, was provided by the appellants pursuant to the court's order. They did not provide any interrogatory responses as the court had ordered. They did not sign off on the original interrogatory answers as the court had ordered. They did not produce the documents as the court had ordered. Instead,
may I ask about that? Does the record reflect, did you ever ask to inspect the originals, which was an alternative, I think, in the order to compel in July of 2022, produce legible copies or provide the originals pursuant to Rule 34?
Honestly, I don't remember, Your Honor, if I did or not. If I did, it would have been in a letter, and I don't remember doing that, but I can't say truthfully to the court whether I did or didn't do that. I know that I asked for the documents to be provided. I know I did that several times, but I can't honestly answer that question.
Mr. Clutcher, I'm looking at the district court's July 20, 2022 order, and I see the reference to 7 days with respect to the order to produce legible documents and photographs. Are you suggesting that 7 days timeline applies to the other discovery that the court ordered appellant's counsel or appellant to comply with?
I think that's a reasonable reading of the court's order that they required. I don't think you can make any argument that you could wait until after the discovery period closed to provide the documents. You have to keep in mind, too, Your Honor, we filed another motion to compel on September 9th when they didn't provide the documentation. Normally, somebody, when they're faced with something like that, would comply with the order at that point in time rather than face another motion. But they didn't even do that. They never provided anything in response to the motion. They did take a deposition, so obviously they were still working on the case and doing things related to it, but they didn't seek to comply with the court's order. And I think that's one of the underlying problems of this is we brought three separate motions related to this. The court ordered them twice to provide the discovery to us and reserve the issue of sanctions, specifically warning them that sanctions would be provided if they didn't take action. And
Did the
so,
court ever make it clear that dismissal with prejudice was one of the sanctions that appellants risked by not complying with the orders to compel?
the court did not specifically say that in its court order, but it certainly was the relief that we were requesting before the court and had requested on two occasions. And the court itself said it was reserving that issue. As in the Frontier case, while the court there didn't specifically suggest that dismissal was proper, this court noted in the Frontier case that the clear warning to them that sanctions would be given was sufficient to meet the requirement under the law. And that clearly was given by the court here in its April 17th, 2023 order that was provided to them. And this is also a pattern of conduct that happened in this case. Not only did they not answer the discovery, but repeatedly over the course of it, they failed to obey court orders. They didn't file their witness list as required by the court order. They didn't file an exhibit list with detailed exhibits as required under the general rules of practice. They didn't file their jury instructions or their special verdict form.
Counsel,
None of those
it
items were.
doesn't appear that though, if we focus on what the district court relied on, I mean, perhaps we could go beyond. I think you're talking about things that went beyond what the district court relied on in its order, dismissing. Is it appropriate for us to go beyond that to look for a pattern that the district court didn't consider?
The district court did mention in its order in the memorandum the failure to comply with the deadlines the court had. It's in one sentence in the memorandum that accompanies the court order. They mention it.
Yeah, I mentioned
So,
not responding to your motions, I think, and then the amended exhibit list and the lateness of it. Here's my question for you. I mean, I appreciate the absence of responses. I want to focus on the prejudice to you.
sure.
You know, you got the answers to interrogatories and requests for documents and the amended one answers. Thereafter, I think in June of 2022, deposed the plaintiff. I don't see in the record that you later asked to depose him again as you got more stuff. I don't know, maybe you did, but it doesn't seem to be part of it anyway. But you deposed the plaintiff, Mr. Dooley. There's a summary judgment motion, so there are exhibits, et cetera, deposition testimony there. You get to, it doesn't look like a document heavy case. Particularly, and they're closely held. I think get there three parties on either side, but it's an individual and they seem closely held. What did you not understand going into trial if you had gone to trial that day? What did you not understand about the plaintiff's case such that you are prejudiced by the absence of getting, you know, signed interrogatory, executed interrogatory answers, and so on?
The basic thing that wasn't understood, and one of the key points we were trying to get to with the interrogatories themselves, was what the alleged contract was with each of the different parties. So when you looked at the complaint itself, it alleged broadly that there was this contract with all three parties. We were seeking to determine through separate interrogatories from each defendant to each plaintiff what the alleged contract was with each of those parties so that we could determine what the claim actually was going to be. because it was unclear whether the claim was for an oral contract or whether it was a claim for the written contract that was much later. And we were trying to drill down and figure out what that exact claim was. So we were left going to trial, not knowing exactly what they were claiming the contract was. And that's what we were trying to flush out. The second part was by not having
Wouldn't
assigned.
That have been information that you could obtain through deposition questions?
I asked those kinds of questions in the deposition. Obviously, the full transcript isn't before the court. I wish it was. But those answers were not provided clearly in the deposition. The reason they weren't, I suspect, is that Mr. Dooley, not being a lawyer, doesn't understand the distinctions between various entities and trying to flesh that out, which is one of the reasons you use interrogatories, because it can bring that to the case and flush out what the contentions of the party actually are and what they're going to actually claim at the trial. And that's why interrogatories become so important in this context specifically.
So did Mr. Dooley just object to the questions asked in the deposition? So there was no response that you could rely on at all? Or were the responses unhelpful for lack of detail that a lawyer would afford?
Yeah, it's really the lack of detail that you would get through a lawyer that could be spelled out and stated more clearly, which is, of course, why you go with interrogatories to get that more detail when you're doing something like this. On the issue of the signing of the interrogatories themselves, obviously, if I didn't have the signed interrogatories, I didn't have available to me the method of impeachment that I could present to a jury. And so not being able to impeach Mr. Dooley related to the original answers to their interrogatories is also a prejudice to us going forward.
And then my same question to you then about, you know, there are some differences in the two sets. Mr. Dahl said his client, you know, at least Mr. I'm not sure communicated or if Mr. Dahl believes his client couldn't sign the first ones truthfully. Why can't those be essentially withdrawn and the amended ones that were executed be the documents that you needed? They don't look that appreciably different.
Well, there's one key difference that I can point out to you. And one of those key difference talks about there being two components to some kind of contract. It's not clear who it's with, but some kind of contract where it says there had to be a securing of a contract with New Look Contracting and Forest Lake Contracting. The reason that's so important is in the deposition testimony, he testified clearly that he never secured a contract from New Look Contracting. So if that, in fact, was a term of the contract, it then makes it impossible for him to be entitled to be paid any money related to the contract because that term would not be fulfilled. So
and
it
is the contract that you're referring to, the answer you're referring to from the amended ones or from the previous, the originals?
It's in the original ones, and that is only to Mr. Ross's interrogatories, not to any of the other entities' interrogatories. So they only responded to Mr. Ross's interrogatories in the original ones, not in the subsequent ones. Part of the reason we're trying to flesh out what these alleged terms are and what they relate to. That's one of the big differences I noticed between the interrogatories and why I wanted to get signed ones, because I thought that was important for an impeachment purpose in the event there was a trial, and why he did not sign them. I'm not sure exactly, because he's never explained why he hasn't signed them specifically.
What does that mean with respect to what we're hearing and what was in the briefs, that it was communicated at least that, I guess, to the court that he couldn't truthfully sign them? What's a district court supposed to do with that if that were in fact true? Is it fair to order a signing of something that turns out not to be true?
Well, I think it would go to the factor of whether there was a justification for not complying with the court's order, being able to explain what the reason was behind it. And they never were able to provide that justification to the court under the frontier factors. And because you didn't provide that justification, how was the court supposed to see if you were justified in what you were doing or not doing? I mean, I think the Love case, which we cited, I know was not a binding precedent, but we did find one case across this country where the argument was made that you can't, you know, somebody didn't want to sign it because they'd commit perjury. And the court said, no, the rules require you to sign it. So that's not a valid excuse. And that was really the only excuse that they offered, but they didn't go into detail behind it. So The other part is they didn't produce the documents they were supposed to produce. They said to the court they didn't have the documents, but then shortly before trial, they produced a number of documents, specifically invoices. And we were not able to go out, depose those individuals who allegedly received this dirt, talk to those individuals to get them as witnesses, list them on our exhibit list and witness list if they had any documents to list exhibits or list those as witnesses to testify at the trial. And that's what happens.
Mr. Clutch, I mean, that strikes me as one of your strongest prejudice arguments is the late disclosure, the failure to disclose until just immediately before trial. But why wouldn't a continuance of the trial be the appropriate sanction for that failure?
I think it boils down to the fact, if you look at the history of the case, Your Honor, this has gone on for months and months and months where they've been ordered to comply. The court's already continued the trial from August to May and then from May to July. So the trial's been moved multiple times already. So when you do that over and over again, you've given somebody multiple opportunities to comply with the court orders. What's to say that if you continue the trial again, something is going to change, that their conduct is going to be different going forward? It's not. They're showing by their conduct that they have no intention to comply with this. We're going to be going back and asking the court again for documents. If they produce some of those documents, where are the rest of them that they had? And
Well,
they showed
counsel,
this
may I
report.
ask about that? So the documents, going back to the invoices you said were produced late, when were those produced?
They were produced around July 12th. So July 12th, they did a supplementation of 2023, and the trial was set for July 24th of 2023. And so it was right around that time frame. I can't remember the exact date they came in, but that was the date they did this supplementation. And then we did a memo to the court on July 19th explaining what was still not in compliance with the court order and filed that with the court, because obviously the time frame for all this had passed long before, and we were trying to get that in front of the court and submit the interrogatories that they had
Another,
submitted.
oh, we're running low on time. I wanted to ask another question. Another question with respect to late disclosed documents, and I'm not sure whether expert witnesses are in this category, and I did want to hear from you for a second about any witnesses. Is I think you also moved, I mean, I'm sure you did motions in limine. Why isn't just suppress, excluding that evidence that disclosed late a sanction for those late disclosures?
Part of it boils down to the overall scheme of the trial, right? What you're trying to do. Potentially, excluding the documents themselves for these invoices, if they are valid, is harmful to us because that goes against his claim for unjust enrichment. But it also is harmful for us that we can't go get these individuals to come in and testify. So we're put on the razor's edge of trying to make a determination of how we want to try the case, without knowing what these individuals are going to say. So having a continuance moving things out doesn't resolve the problem. It creates more prejudice because now they want to try to put in more evidence that they never disclosed earlier. And so this keeps getting continued over and over and over again without any resolution. And frankly, if my client's expected to comply with the rules, they've got to be expected to comply with the rules. How can I go tell my clients you had to do this and comply, and they don't have to go do this and comply? It smacks of unfairness. It's like going to a football game, saying the football game's supposed to start at 3 p.m., and they call off the game and everybody leaves, and then they want to come back and play. It just doesn't work.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Clutcher. Your time has expired, and Mr. Dahl, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Clutcher, if you can mute during this, please.
On the production of documents, I explained repeatedly in every brief I filed, including main brief in this case and the reply brief in this case, that the main complaint of the court and of Mr. Clutcher was documents that weren't that clear. There were some pictures in the in provided that weren't the documentation wasn't that clear. And the fact of the matter is, I didn't have better documents. I explained my client was an excavator. And drove big trucks, and he kept all his records on his iPhone. And
But
I
did
put
Mr.
there
Dahl,
weren't.
didn't you eventually provide better copies? That's what I understand in the record.
No, I did not. What happened? Here's what happened. What happened was those pictures that I'm talking about have nothing to do with those. What happened was I found additional receipts that Mr. Dooley had given to me that I didn't even know I had. And in fact is Mr. Clutcher's being a little disingenuous with the receipts, because the receipts, if you go actually look at them, all they pertain to in this case is the issue of damages, how much damage here or there, and others plus or minus. It does not go to whether there was a contract in this case, which is the big issue in the case, is what was their contract and who was a contract with. It just is related to damages. And Mr. Clutcher really didn't explain that to you. The other thing is I explained to the judge why I couldn't comply to that. He explained it multiple times to him. As far as the trials, the judge set the trial on this thing originally in February of 2022 in August. There was no way this case was ever going to be done by have written discovery and all the depositions taken in August. It was an extremely unrealistic idea to try this in 6 months. What happened was I had vasculitis, so I asked for the judge to continue the trial. He ended up moving it to May. I did not move the case from May to July. What happened was the judge had a conflict with a criminal case. So this is typical of Mr. Clutcher. Mr. Clutcher takes and blames all these this on me, where he's going to blame especially the moving of the trial from May to July on me, when he knows that that was because the judge had a criminal case that conflicted with it, and that's why the case was moved from May to July. I've explained in my briefs why they are not prejudiced, and he did not give this court one good reason saying they're prejudiced. The reason, really, if you really go to the transcript and you look at this case, the reason the judge was upset was because he didn't like my subpoena under Rules 45 bringing in that new stuff. That was upsetting to him that I brought that new material into the case, because he knew there was going to be an argument about that, and he didn't want that. But the easy solution was simply to continue this case, because they kept trying to allege my client forged the document, which he vehemently denied that he did it. And my expert was going to say, look, it looks like it was signed with big letter, or like a Sharpie with a big pen. It
When did
doesn't.
you, Mr. Dahl, when did you first disclose your expert?
The expert was disclosed before the summary judgment stuff. So all that was disclosed to them. There was no, there wasn't, oh, I know, and I need to cover one thing. If you go look on page set or paragraph 7 on page 2 of my First Amendment complaint, what I say there is Defendant JR Enterprise and Defendant Great Lakes Lumber Company are owned, operated, and managed as the alter ego of Defendant Ross. Defendant Ross, JR Enterprise, and Great Lakes Inc. have commingled their assets, contracts, and other business dealings. The court in the summary judgment, when he ruled on that, understood that this was about an alter ego theory. And Mr. Kletcher has pretended to you that he was trying to find out my client, he was assuming that my client had a separate contract with those three defendants. That was never alleged, that was never pled. And he was trying to put words in my client's mouth at his deposition to that effect, to trying to allege, and that's all that his deal was with the motion to compel. He was trying to take and manipulate the evidence and the things to say there was three separate contracts, or there were not three separate contracts with three people. That wasn't even an issue in the case. He was taking and trying to confound the issues in the case and make it confusing, because he knew his client agreed to this agreement. He says, you got to be more particular, Mr. Dahl. When his client drafted the contract, he emailed the contract to me, and he attached documents to the contract. In fact, is the reason the court denied the summary judgment motion was because the documentation to the other party that was involved in this case, they gave us a pile of records that showed that Ross put his company's name, Great Lakes' name,
Mr.
and all these
Dahl,
different people on emails and everything. So there
your
was a
time has, Mr.
commingling.
Dahl,
Go ahead.
your time has expired. And we went over, I know, a little bit for both of you and principal arguments in here. So I think, barring any questions from my co-panel members, I believe the oral arguments then are concluded. We thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. And the case is submitted, and we will have a decision out within the statutory time period.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank
Thank
you
you,
very
Court.
much.
I appreciate your time. Thank you very
Thank
much.
you.